For those of you keeping score at home, we're celebrating a little anniversary today. This is program number 1500 in this series. To celebrate, we're looking back in our archives and looking up to the sky.
There's 5 or 6 times more stuff in a galaxy than is just hot and glowy.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about cosmic voids, a whole lot of nothing in space. We'll also spend an academic minute exploring hundreds of tiny planets. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. When you think about it, the name cosmic voids is pretty self-explanatory. But that would make for a very short segment, and there's a lot of neat stuff up there in the cosmos to talk about. We did that a few years ago with Dr. Paul Sutter. Dr. Sutter is now a cosmological researcher and community outreach coordinator with the Department of Astronomy at Ohio State University. We had a great time talking about the universe and all the nothing that's up there. And now that the best of our knowledge is a little bit longer, we can include some more of that conversation. I started by asking the obvious question, what are cosmic voids?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at a spider web or you look at, say, Swiss cheese, or you look at a sponge or you look at foam, you can describe the structure of that mathematically, either by looking at the actual web and filaments and the stuff, or you can describe it by the complement with the empty spaces.
And in this web, the web that is the universe, there's empty spaces, and then there's really empty spaces that are called cosmic voids. First of all, just give us a quick definition of cosmic void, or is there such a thing as a quick definition of a cosmic void?
Yeah, there is a quick definition of a cosmic void, and it's totally self-explanatory. It's void of matter. It's literally empty spaces in the cosmos. There's no galaxies. There's no gas. There isn't even any dark matter. It's just empty space. And these empty spaces fill up most of the volume of the universe. Just like if you looked at a spider web and put a box around that spider web and counted up how much of the space is taken up by the actual web and how much space is taken up by nothing at all, most of the box would be nothing at all. And it's the exact same way with the universe. So around 80 to 90% of the volume of the universe is just completely empty, devoid of matter, and hence cosmic void.
So space itself is actually just another name for cosmic void?
Well, space permeates everything. Like, we think of space-time as the stage on which we all play our acts, where matter and energy and forces do their thing. But then there's places of the universe with no matter, and no forces, just emptiness.
And these were discovered back in the 70s, correct?
Yeah, in the very first galaxy surveys, when we first started building powerful telescopes that could start to map out where in the universe are galaxies. We just want to know, for every single galaxy in the universe, where it is. And we can start to build up a map of the largest scales in the universe. And when they first started doing this, they really had no idea what to expect. It could be galaxies could be just kind of scattered around randomly, like if you're throwing like salt down on a table. They could have clumped up into very large clumps with nothing in between. But what they discovered instead was this very intriguing web-like pattern. And that was the discovery of the first cosmic void, its first empty region in the distribution of galaxies.
And a few years after that, I think it was 1981, there was the Boötes Void that was discovered. Why was that an important discovery?
The Boötes Void was important because it was important for two reasons. One, it was the first, like, really confirmed void. Earlier, when we had first started sketching out where galaxies are distributed in our universe, there were the hints of voids, and there were the initial papers and the research on it. But the Boötes Void was like a clear signal. It was clearly defined. We had mapped it out in three dimensions. And also, we had found that it was incredibly large. It was much larger than any theoretical prediction of how structure ought to be in our universe, how structure ought to evolve over the billions of years in our universe. Those early models, those early theories just hadn't predicted the existence of such large, empty regions. And the Boötes Void was really the first one to show just how big and how empty these regions were, and that forced us to... Not me personally, but scientists that came before me, forced us to kind of rethink how structure evolves and how galaxies arrange themselves in our universe.
How did that thinking evolve from, okay, there's a star there, there's a star there, and there's nothing in between, to, okay, a star there, but somewhere in there, there's a void?
Yeah, so we have to think bigger than stars, actually. We're talking about whole galaxies. So our entire Milky Way galaxy, which every star you see in the sky is a member of our own galaxy, we're talking about scales even bigger than that, where this cosmic web is, I like to say, it's made of galaxies. The cosmic web is made of galaxies the same way that your body is made of cells. So a galaxy is really, really tiny compared to the size of a void or the size of the structure of the cosmic web. And when we first started doing galaxy surveys, trying to pinpoint where galaxies are in the universe, you can imagine the first generation of telescopes, the first generation of cameras, they're not very sensitive. They can only see the brightest galaxies. They can only see nearby galaxies. So when there was this first hints of a cosmic web, the first hints of the detection of this kind of structure, the natural question to ask was, is this something fundamental? Is this something that's really reflecting the fundamental structure in our universe? Or are we just missing a bunch of dim galaxies? Are our optics not good enough? Are our telescopes not sensitive enough? Like, is there more stuff there that we just happen to not see? But over time, over the decades, where we introduce new methods, we introduce more powerful telescopes, it really appears to be something fundamental, that there isn't just random gaps here and there. There isn't just galaxies that are too dim to see. There really are fundamental, large, empty spaces in the universe that are tied to this structure that we've identified.
And over those decades, as technology improved and we could see more and understand more, has the importance of these voids become, well, more important?
Yeah, we're starting to recognize the reason we're doing galaxy surveys, besides the fact that it's fun and cool to do, is we're trying to do cosmology, which is the study of the physics of the universe at the very largest scale. So we're trying to figure out what the universe is made of. We're trying to figure out the history of the universe. And mapping galaxies, figuring out what the structure of the universe is, the arrangement of galaxies in our universe, helps us understand the ingredients, the components in the history of the universe. Just like if you change the ingredients in a recipe, or you change how long you cook something, you change what you made. And it's the same way with the universe. If you change what the universe is made of, or you change the underlying physics, you end up with different kinds of structure. You end up with different arrangements of galaxies. And by studying properties of that structure, you can try to dig out what the universe is made of. And we've come to realize over the past, say, 5 to 10 years, that voids are exceptionally interesting places to do this. they're an interesting way to look at and study and gather statistics on the structure of matter in the universe, because their emptiness is a virtue. So you'd think that the empty places would be, say, devoid of information, but really they're full of information. Their shapes, their sizes, their arrangement, their population are all intimately tied to the fundamental ingredients in our universe. And earlier when I said that voids are empty, I cheated a little. They are empty of matter. There's no galaxies and there's no gas, there's no dark matter. But they are full of something we call dark energy. And dark energy was just discovered about 15 years ago, 15 to 20 years ago. And dark energy is really just a name we give to something we don't understand in cosmology. Dark energy is the name we give to the fact that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. So we've known for a long time, we've known for 100 years that the universe is expanding. Edwin Hubble discovered this. But it was only 15 or 20 years ago that we discovered that this expansion is getting faster and faster and faster every day. And we don't know what causes this. This is a complete and total mystery in cosmology. We give it a label called dark energy, and it seems to be a property of fundamental space-time. So if you take a box and you get rid of all the atoms and you get rid of all the dark matter, you're left with pure vacuum, pure empty space. But that empty space carries with it some sort of energy that we don't really understand. We call this dark energy. And this dark energy is responsible for the accelerated expansion of the universe. So by looking at voids, voids are really full of empty space, which means they're full of dark energy. And so by studying the properties of voids, we can get like a window into the properties of dark energy itself, into this very fundamental thing that appears to be driving the accelerated expansion of our universe.
And you've called them laboratories to study this expansion and what the universe is made of, right?
Yeah, exactly. So you think of a laboratory, a scientific laboratory, like a clean room where you're trying to get rid of all the contaminants so that you can really study and focus in on one thing. And we could study dark energy in, say, a galaxy or a cluster of galaxies or even in a solar system. Like if you create a vacuum here on Earth, there's dark energy there. It's dark energy. It permeates the entire universe. But galaxies are busy places. There's lots of stuff going on. There's stars blowing up. There's magnetic fields. There's people talking on phones, having interviews on the radio. Like, it's pretty messy, complicated place. So if you want to study that very fundamental background dark energy, you have to get rid of all the contamination. You have to subtract out all that noisy, messy stuff to get at that pure dark energy that you're trying to study. Well, voids give us exactly that place. Because there's no matter, because there's no gas, because there's no dark matter, there's only dark energy inside of them. So dark energy is like at the fore. It's at the front. It allows us to easily separate it from any other kind of physical effects that might be going on. And it allows us to tie very cleanly the properties of dark energy to the properties of the voids that we observe in the universe.
Still to come, okay, we've heard a lot about cosmic voids and dark energy, but what's this dark matter that Dr. Sutter tried to sneak by us? We'll find out next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Dr. Paul Sutter, a cosmological researcher and community outreach coordinator with the Department of Astronomy at Ohio State University. We're listening again to a conversation we had a while back about cosmic voids, and we just heard Dr. Sutter mention dark matter. So I said, whoa, let's back up the theoretical truck here and explain just what that is.
So dark matter is a component of our universe. Our universe appears to be made of stars and gas and then something else, some other kind of matter that simply doesn't interact with light, and hence the name dark matter. We infer the existence of dark matter. We don't have any direct observations of this stuff that appears to be in the universe yet, but it does interact with everything else gravitationally. So when we look at, say, a galaxy or a cluster of galaxies, and we try to weigh it, we try to figure out how much stuff is inside that galaxy or that cluster of galaxies, we've devised several different methods that are really cool for figuring out how much stuff is inside of a galaxy. And if you add up all that stuff and compare it to the amount of stars and the amount of gas that you can actually measure, there's a big difference. There's 5 or 6 times more stuff in a galaxy than is just hot and glowy. And so we guess that there must be something inside of galaxies that makes up most of the stuff in a galaxy, but we simply can't see. It's not hot and it's not glowing at us, but it's there. It makes its presence known through gravity. And so most of the universe, if you look at a galaxy through a telescope, you see all the stars, you see the hot gas, but most of what you're looking at is actually made up of some unknown form of matter that doesn't interact with light, and this makes up, say, the backbone of our cosmic web. It makes up the backbone of the fundamental structure of our universe. But even the voids, they're not just empty of the galaxies and empty of stars and empty of gas. There's also very little dark matter.
So if you can't identify it, it's dark.
Basically, that's the default way that cosmologists operate.
Okay.
If you make an observation and it doesn't make sense, it gets called dark.
Okay. Everybody needs a fallback.
That's exactly.
Can you easily tell the difference between, okay, that's a void, oh no, that's just dark matter over there?
The way we think of galaxies is, I just heard this very nice metaphor. Imagine you're looking at a distant mountain range, and there's snow just at the very peaks of the mountains. And let's say that it's fog or it's a little bit dark, and you can't see the mountains themselves. You can only see a little hint of white snow at the tips of the mountains. But you know the whole mountain has to be there in order for there to be a peak with snow on it that you can see. So the snow at the top of the mountains are like the galaxies. Those are the bits that we can see. But they're sitting on top of a massive mountain of dark matter, a part of the universe that we can't see. And so when we see galaxies, they're like tracers of the dark matter. They're like little signal lights telling us where the dark matter is arranged in the universe. And this is confirmed with lots of tests, with simulations comparing to theory, so that when we see a big giant void in the distribution of galaxies, when we see a region with no galaxies in it, we have very high confidence that it is also empty of dark matter, because we believe that the galaxies are like lighting up where there's a lot of dark matter. And where there's no galaxies, there's also no dark matter.
Okay. Let's go back to the voids. I imagine the closest one we can see is still hundreds of light years away.
Yeah, to give you a sense of the scale involved here, so our own, and these numbers, astronomical numbers, they always get big, and it's hard to like imagine, it's hard to provide any context in the human realm, but our own galaxy is about 100,000 light years across, which means it takes a beam of light 100,000 years to go from one end to another. The smallest void that we've seen is around 10,000 times bigger than that. So it really is, if you look at a spider web and how thin the actual thread of the spider web is compared to the big gaps in between, that gives you some sense of the scales involved.
It's a whole lot of nothing.
Yeah, a whole lot of nothing. Hmm.
Do these voids have any rhyme or reason? Do they follow patterns?
Yeah, and actually this is something we've just recently discovered, is that there's some sort of universal behavior to the voids. And by behavior, I don't mean like animals running around. I mean, if you look at their shapes and how many big voids there are and how many little voids there are and how many medium voids there are, or if you look at how empty they are in the center compared to how much stuff is on the outer edges, it appears to obey certain universal, what we call scaling laws. There's like some fundamental relationship between how empty a void is in the center and how much stuff is at the edge of the void. Or there's a fundamental relationship between how many small voids there are in the universe and how many big voids there are in the universe. And these relationships, we've discovered, depend on the mix of ingredients in our universe. So if we happen to find ourselves in a different universe with a different amount of dark energy or different amount of dark matter, then this relationship between, say, the number of small voids to the number of big voids, or the relationship between how empty a void is to how much stuff is on the edges, changes in a very clear way. And so this is one of the ways we're using to use the void properties to pin down exactly how much dark energy we have in the universe and how much dark matter we have.
And the more voids that you can discover, does that make it easier to find out what these universal laws must be?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like, if you're trying to figure out a relationship between amount of education and test scores in a population of people, if you just have three or four people, you may discover some hints of a relationship that the more education they have, the better they do at tests, for example. But you can't really say anything statistically significant. You can't say anything definite. You need more people. You need a bigger sample to tease out these kind of relationships. And so as we operate our telescopes, as we operate our galaxy surveys, where we're trying to collect and map out even larger volumes of the universe, the more voids we have, the better we understand this relationship, and the better we can turn this relationship into more precise knowledge about the ingredients of our universe.
You talked about your computer simulations. Can these simulations show what the view must be like from the middle of a void?
You actually can figure this out. It turns out if you were to take our entire Milky Way galaxy and plunk it down inside the middle of a big void, our night sky wouldn't change at all. Or it hardly change. That's because all the stars you see, around 3,000 stars, I think, in the northern sky, and then another 3,000 in the southern sky, that's just one tiny little bubble of our Milky Way galaxy. So in the whole sky, you see about 6,000 stars, but there's about 300 million stars in just our own Milky Way galaxy. So our night sky wouldn't change. What would change is when we start to make large galaxy surveys and try to map out, like, okay, where's the nearest galaxy? Where's the next nearest galaxy? Where's the one after that? We've discovered that these galaxies are really, really far away from each other.
So what's next? What's the next big discovery that needs to be made with these?
So what needs to happen, or what we're pushing in the direction of, is right now we've mapped out about 2,000 voids, and that's with current galaxy surveys that are operating now. There's the next generation of galaxy surveys that are being built and designed right now, and these are satellite-based ones. So there's one being run by the Europeans called the Euclid mission, and another one that's in the design phase by NASA called WFIRST. Both of these are going to be satellites. And they're just going to map out tremendous volumes of the universe, like increase our mapping of the universe by orders of magnitude. And right now, with our current technology and our current skill level, we have about 2,000 voids. In the next 5 to 10 years, once these missions are launched and hopefully they don't blow up, they actually get up to space and do what they're supposed to do, we're going to have around 1 million voids. That's how much we predict from our simulation. So we're going to go from 2,000 to around 1 million. And with that comes an incredible increase in precision, and it allows us to use these objects as like a very precise probe for studying how much dark energy and dark matter are in our universe.
Dr. Paul Sutter is a cosmological researcher and community outreach coordinator with the Department of Astronomy at Ohio State University. You can learn more about Dr. Sutter's work at pmsutter.com. So in addition to cosmic voids, there are a whole lot of tiny planets floating around in space, too. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Is there a giant unknown planet beyond Neptune? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Robert Brown, associate professor of astronautics at the United States Air Force Academy, discusses whether Planet 9 is changing our solar system.
There are over 1,600 known minor planets that exist beyond Neptune's orbit. These small bodies are called trans-Neptune objects, or TNOs for short. Over the last few years, researchers, including our own group, discovered that 6 to 12 TNOs that travel farthest from the Sun have similar orbits. This was very puzzling and led one research team to propose that there is a giant undetected planet well beyond Neptune, which they called Planet 9. They postulated that gravitational forces from this hypothetical planet have kept 6 of the largest TNO orbits near each other. However, our research showed that it is not just the TNOs with very large orbits that are close together. A key characteristic of all TNO orbits is also clustered together. This was unexpected because small perturbations from the known giant planets like Jupiter, Saturn, and Neptune move TNO orbits a little. These perturbations are slightly different for each TNO, so over time their orbits should spread apart. We showed that gravitational perturbations from our known planets would cause all the TNO orbits to be spread out evenly in only about 3 million years. Yet they are still clustered together today. What could explain this? Why are the orbits of over 1,600 TNOs not evenly distributed today? We also determined that the proposed Planet 9 could not explain the clustering of these orbits. Therefore, we concluded that there is no reason to believe this hypothetical planet exists at all. Instead, we postulated that TNOs have only been in their present orbits for less than a few million years. Other recent research we published proposed that TNOs recently moved from inside Neptune's orbit, which could explain why elements of their orbits are similar today. There are certainly many more questions that need to be answered regarding these unusual bodies. Hopefully, the answers to these questions will help us to better understand our solar system.
That was Robert Brown of the United States Air Force Academy. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.